Welcome back to Gregory and Paul Show. I'm Gregory.
And I'm Paul.
And we break down latest SaaS startups, AI. I'm wearing my t-shirt, getting ready for my
Seattle
Tech Week talk. Yeah, they banned data centers in the city of Seattle. So I just want everyone to be clear, like, where I stand, you could build one next door to me, no problem. I don't have any issue with it.
Yes, data center in my backyard.
Hey, that is actually something that NVIDIA is working on. But anyway, we have a great show for today. We are going to break down a new report from Ramp that shows AI is actually creating jobs, not destroying them. I want to touch on SpaceX valuation. They lost, depending on how you measure it, $1 trillion in value. So I don't want to go silent like all of the other Elon fanboys have now that stock has dropped a bit. I think it's important to touch on that. I personally am not surprised. Seems to be holding at $150 a share. I suspect it may go down a little bit more, but we'll get into that. There is a text thread I want to discuss with you, Paul, about SaaS is dying, or is it? We'll talk about physical AI, the robotics revolution. I found this fantastic report. I don't know if you saw this in the doc, but like The Economist did an analysis of all the different AI models to uncover what kind of values they have. You actually, I don't think, will be quite surprised to understand what kind of values they have once you see how it works, what the test was, how they plotted it out. Fascinating stuff. We'll talk about Anthropic's $1 billion profit, and we'll get into creepy AI glasses. But first, Paul, I have breaking news. Mark Zuckerberg has posted on X for the first time in over 3 years. And do you know what he had to say?
Is it a product launch announcement?
That's right. Use Spark 1.1. So what did he call it? He wrote, "It is a strong, authentic encoding model at a very low price. It's available through our new Meta Model API and in Meta AI." So they're getting into the coding race. They also announced, was it last week, that they would be providing cloud services. This is something I don't know if you and I ever discussed this, but like there's been a lot of chatter on how Facebook has been making this massive investment in AI infrastructure, and to what end? They don't offer cloud services in the same way that Azure does or Google Cloud does or Oracle does. So like, what were they like building out all this hardware, building all these data centers? It had been speculated that maybe they were going to offer some type of enterprise solution. And lo and behold, they are. They want to be a competitor in the cloud space. They now have their own coding model. Paul, you are our resident vibe coding expert.
Yeah.
What is your perspective?
So full story, circle back kind of announcement. They've been killing their entire dev team by assigning them essentially like keylogging all of their activities on their computers to what is rumored to train this AI model for coding agents. So it seems like this is probably the release of all the efforts coming out of these rumors. I'm super interested to see how long he can keep this up, and if this, from the capabilities sheet, it performs better than Opus 4.8 Max. I'm a little bit skeptical, but I'm kind of like curious to get my hands on this and try it myself. There's a lot of AI model releases this week. Grok also came out with a model that I'm very, very interested to try as well.
Yeah.
So there's lots of competition for coding models today.
I know. I know.
I do wonder if this,
I'm sorry.
I do wonder if they're both late to the game.
Yeah, it's like a commodity, right? Like it's clear that it's a race to the bottom. There's tons of these things out there. There's open source versions. There's cheap versions. You know, I mean, obviously there's a lot of strategic value if you can own a certain part of the stack.
Sure.
You know, and like Meta, they've been very good at copying other people and executing well on it. I think they are an execution machine, unlike other companies out there. I would even say that like OpenAI appears to be not perhaps executing as well as I think they, could or should. I think they've been out-executed by Anthropic, actually. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here. Do you think it's too crowded? Are there too many places? Or do you think they can carve out their own space? I don't really know what to make of this from a business perspective. I have like mixed thoughts.
I think it's, for coding agents, I think it's super crowded. They don't have the same kind of distribution. Even though that has tweaked off, 6 million views now? I just don't think Facebook has the same kind of distribution power in this vertical. They could clone Slapchat, and immediately overnight, they have a billion users of stories. But
yes,
with
correct.
Coding agents, there's no incentive for me to care. They released MuSpark on top of Grok announcement. Gemini 3.5 Pro is also rumored to be releasing soon. There's a new OpenAI model that's rumored to be releasing next month. So out of all of these releases, on top of open source models from China, GLM 5.0, really, really good. There's just like very, very, very few incentives for me to try this out.
Yeah, there's some stock analysts I'm looking at right now who says, hey, LLMs are becoming a commodity at this point to race the bottom. But
correct.
If Meta can produce something better than Claude Codex Grok, is there a big enterprise business for them? That's what I might question. And then he's like, he says, if this model takes off, does Wall Street punish Meta for spending all its money on CapEx instead of spending money on coding? Means there's like any reason for them. Was it, if spending on CapEx, because spending money to build a coding model means there's reason for the spend. Right. So trying to justify the cap, like, so is this, so, okay, I understand what he's trying to say here. They're making this massive investment in CapEx no matter what. They've been doing it for years. So now they go, oh, we have this coding model. Is it a way to just justify the CapEx spend? It's an interesting, like, kind of Wall Street perspective, like, why is spending all this money on it? I don't know. I if I was to just kind of summarize, I think I've tweeted about this. They're AI strategy over Meta is very confusing. Like, they hire people, they fire people, they made those like $100 million offers to people and then got rid of them. And then they had the scale AI thing. He's gone, even though he's got awesome hair, I would have left him around. Like, it's just wild. And now they're going to go into B2B. They've never been in B2B before. They're going to like start, they're going to build a sales team. They're going to sell this stuff. Like, who are they going to sell it to? I just have so many questions and it just seems so random.
Yeah, it seems completely random, right?
Like, I guess that's like my take, actually. It's
yeah, it just seems random. Very, very random. He's competing in a business where he has zero advantage over, right? Like, Grok makes sense because Elon is also building Colossus. Hypothetically, he has a Tesla fleet that could turn into cloud computers that he could deploy front models to.
100%.
He has the hardware behind it, right? Google, of course, makes sense. Anthropic OpenAI has the first mover advantages. For Facebook to come in and compete on coding agent models just makes no sense to me. He has like all of this training data from content on Instagram and Facebook. He could hypothetically compete with YouTube on a better image vision video model, but he's not. So it's very confusing for me.
Yeah, I don't know. All right, let's move on. I want to address this report that came out. I've been very vocal about AI and jobs. I retweeted that clip the other day where a while ago I predicted that the jobs apocalypse would not happen. And I think I've been vindicated. And this report from Ramp is really amazing. I don't know if you got a chance to look at it, but I want to read some of the statements from the research that they did, because I think it's actually quite surprising what they found out. So it's called A New Look at AI's Job, AI's Impact on Jobs. I'll put the link in, but you can find it if you do a search. It's easy to find. Abstract, we find that companies that adopt AI tend to grow faster following adoption, but the relationship is driven almost entirely by high intensity adopters. Firms making the largest AI investments grow employment by roughly 10% following adoption, while the low intensity adopters see no statistically significant change. Entry level headcount rises 12% for high intensity adopters. So the opposite is happening. The like leaders, the early adopters, the people who are able to use AI and accelerate with it actually are hiring more because their business is growing and they're scaling and they're doing a great job as a company and they're executing really well, that they just need more capacity overall. Is this Jevons paradox just playing out in right in front of our eyes, or are you on mute?
Overall, I think this completely makes sense, right? The business who adopts AI well are growing faster than business who's not. And when you grow, you need to hire headcount.
Totally. Totally agree.
I think that's, in reality, this is what is happening. So for the businesses who may have not adopted AI because for whatever the reason, they might turn out to be the losers.
So dude, in the report, they actually state this. A couple of things we could discuss. Like, one is that, okay, it's So the gains are uneven. Adopters are already larger, more technical, faster growing firms. So the leaders are the ones that are doing well with this. And they even say in this report that actually these results, they counter any prediction that AI adoption will lead to broad job loss. What I do think it points to is that super firms, super adopters, super productive people are going to become massively productive with AI. And I expect there to be more disparity perhaps between people and firms. I think it'll be more like kind of winners and losers. But that's something we've seen in high tech for a long time. I remember when it was perhaps a bit less disparity between companies. They usually had a sector at a couple of leaders. Now we just see like one leader. I think AI will continue to accelerate that. But it's not eliminating jobs, which I think is the really important takeaway from this report.
So here's something that I'm wondering is, okay, 100% agree that AI is not replacing people because fundamentally the secret sauce for businesses is that we're realizing it's not just the data, it's actually the embedded judgment calls from all of its employees. This is what Satya said about sovereign AI a few weeks ago, where he wrote this like 15,000 or 1500 word essay on this topic. We briefly discussed about this.
Yeah, we talked about it.
So like basically as so far with all the businesses adopting AI, from this report, what I actually gathered is that most businesses are not using AI or not leveraging AI the way that some of the AI native companies are already doing. AI native companies are using AI to encode judgment and encode expertise and context and pulling that out from their most senior members of their staff. Legacy companies are implementing AI as very kind of very low level tools. They're using AI to compile presentations. They're using AI to format documents, sometimes just to help developers write code. So I think what I'm curious to see is in 12 to 24 months, how will we drastically reduce the headcount in AI native companies? And as more AI native companies compete with legacy companies, what these hiring numbers will actually look like.
So you still think there is potential for job loss?
I still think there is potential for job loss at traditional companies. That is merely just kind of integrating AI into their workflows, but not necessarily leveraging AI as better employees, I would even say.
Yeah, so I think the march of innovation and technology always goes on. And with that always comes obsolescence, churn, things change, roles, you know, get reevaluated, reconfigured. Like the forward deployed engineer now is a big difference from how perhaps sales engineers work. So there's lots of organizations now that are building out those spaces and like sunsetting the other ones, right? So there definitely is change, but there's always change in high tech since I've been in this business, right? Roles come and go. I wrote a tweet. There's a bunch of stuff out there about like defunct programming languages, like all kinds of stuff I learned that doesn't exist anymore. Like my favorite, ActionScript. I was very good at ActionScript, knowing that this thing was never going to survive, right? So that's just like, I think this is part of the technology space. The report found they're hiring more junior people, which I think is really interesting. For me, that debunks any fear or concern that jobs at a macro level are going to go away. If you're a sales engineer and you're a smart, capable, motivated person, you should be able to figure out how to become a forward deployed engineer. Like, seems pretty straightforward. And if you're not trying to do that, you should be trying to do that, right? Like, that's right. Inevitable. But those types of things always emerge. And like, I think they're quite obvious. And people have choices. Like, maybe you don't want to do that. And there's nothing wrong with that either. Maybe you want to have your own startup. You want to be something else, right? Like, do it. But change comes. Like, you just can't be complacent and just static. That's the part that I think kills anybody.
For sure. But that's a scary thought, right? It's the same thing as just telling truck drivers to re-educate.
Learn to code. Learn to code.
Exactly.
Learn to code.
It sounds simple, but in practice, it is a scary thing.
Well, okay. That's why I gave the example, like sales engineer to forward deployed engineer, I don't think is a crazy leap. I completely agree. Like, minor learning code is not a viable solution. Totally. And there are going to be people that like lose out. There's always people who lose. I gave that example of like friend of the family where they had like a Chinese translation graphic design business, like just not viable anymore. So there's going to be parts of the economy and businesses that go away.
There will be a segment of the economy who refuses to change, and they will be left behind. I think that probably summarizes this thing. So anyways, I do think like it's interesting that businesses are still hiring. There is a little bit of a survivorship bias, I think, because ramp companies are probably funded and growing. I'm cautiously optimistic about all of this.
All right, let's summarize this as the data says no job loss yet.
Yet, according to Ramp.
According to Ramp. Job loss. Okay. All right.
Job loss canceled.
Job loss canceled for the year. Okay. SaaS is dying. There was this thread that went crazy viral about SaaS dying. I'll read some of it. I genuinely believe we're watching SaaS die in real time, and most people still don't see it. $1 trillion wiped from the software stock since January 26. It's just getting started. SaaS multiples collapsed. Blah, 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 blah. Like, this goes on and on and on, right? He shows like a bunch of charts and, you know, ServiceNow and Salesforce and all of these, like, what I would call legacy companies. Their stocks did get crushed. It's true. There's no denying that. But I don't believe that there is any SaaS apocalypse at all. And the funny part is that I found another tweet that showed Cursor revenue. And the reason I found this is I was doing searches for SaaS and fastest growing SaaS, stuff like that. And this one popped up because they categorized Cursor as SaaS, fastest growing SaaS in the history of SaaS. So you've got, like, on the one end of the spectrum, doomers, you know, people who are saying it's the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And like, they're correct. Like, there is data to point to that shows, like, hey, a lot of public companies that are in the SaaS space stock struggling, right? But they've got other people pointing to, like, new firms saying, like, hey, we've got examples of software companies that are the fastest growing ever. So which is it, Paul? Is SaaS dying, or is SaaS the new space where the fastest growing companies in the world are being created? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, right? Like, it's the definition of SaaS is kind of blurring, right? Like, Lovable is probably the best example in all of this. They grew super fast, well, 100 million revenue. It was the fastest to that mark. Are they SaaS? Are they just the ChatGPT wrapper? I don't know. Like, it's hard to say. So, like, if you look at Lovable and Cursor, of course, it's not SaaS. Is of course not done.
Okay, I'm looking at the chart right now, and it shows, okay, it's the chart to 100 million. I guess this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like top seven. DocuSign was, then it was OpenAI, then it was CoreWeave, then it was Together AI, Deal, Wiz, and now Cursor, fastest to $100 million in ARR. As someone who named their company Vibe Your SaaS, I think the definition of SaaS is software. And I don't think software is going away. And I even think that, like, all this enthusiasm and excitement in the hardware space is still SaaS. Because all of them have some kind of, like, SaaS platform, subscription, some kind of software business. If you're just selling hardware, it's a very difficult business. It's not a great business to be in. You want to have some kind of subscription, some kind of SaaS element too. So I don't think SaaS is going anywhere. I think there's a bunch of, like, public companies that are mature, and the stock market now sees that, like, well, there's going to be a whole bunch of other new companies that are really exciting and are probably going to grow a lot faster than these legacy companies. And that's why the stock valuations aren't what they were.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's the key, right? It's not really that SaaS is dying. This post is saying that some legacy SaaS valuation of the valuation multiples of these companies are getting compressed.
Yeah. They're just using dramatic language. That's my position here.
Right.
Like, this is very dramatic. Like, SaaS correct, is dying. Correct. Like, it's,
correct.
You know.
Okay. So the actual definition is that SaaS is not going to disappear. Useful software in a subscription model will always exist, because people, I think that will never go away, because people will continuously buy it. However, the 10 to 15x multiple that VCs used to pay for a traditional SaaS software product will go away.
100%.
That's what the red line over here is showing, the multiple of these SaaS companies without a new AI strategy is getting compressed. Totally makes sense. 100%.
I don't even think that the models will ultimately subsume everything. That was the other theory, like OpenAI and Anthropic are to go into every business and compete and like everyone's screwed. Like, I don't think that's happening either. I don't even buy the like, I vibe coded my own Gmail and now I have no security and no spam filter and I pay $800 a month for my own Gmail. Like, I don't even buy that. There was this like article that went around recently, like, oh, we vibe coded our own CRM. I mean, maybe, but I think all of those fears are totally overblown.
Yeah. So, okay, here's my observation, because we're talking about this, okay? So the entire premises or the entire thesis of AI is that as the models get better and better, everything that's wrapping this model will get better as well. So you have like, you have basically two power laws kind of stacked on to each other, right? With SaaS, it's just one, where you write better code or you build better products. And you eventually will have like a hockey stick style growth because you're compounding the improvements on top of each other. With AI, there's two power laws or two compounding forces. So far, I've not seen this unfold in a way that a lot of companies or a lot of VCs, pundits, or even founders have predicted 12 to 16 months ago when ChatGPT 3.0 came out. Like when ChatGPT came out, a lot of these wrapper companies, they're saying that like, you know, yeah, today we're kind of struggling to make lovable sites. Tomorrow or 18 months later, because of the dual compounding effect, one person in his like bedroom can make a like Salesforce. I've not seen that coming true, and I'm not seeing the models themselves are putting us on that trajectory because of one cost. Models are getting more and more expensive. Frontier models like Fable are actually getting less access because of the government policies. So there's like a lot of these headwinds that's causing the models to not compound the way that we predicted 2 years ago.
Yeah, so you're saying that we've reached some kind of plateau.
There's a lot of, whether it's like hard tech plateau, as in we're running out of chips and memories to support these models, or to government policies. Like the US government literally said, you cannot have frontier model access.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I also think there's limits to like the technology itself. There's other people who identify this too, like language, like large language models are maybe not the solution to everything, and that they'll hit some kind of plateau. They get really good at certain things, but they can't really evolve beyond that. I mean, I buy that as a theory, and I kind of feel like—
Correct, yeah.
Improvements like, are still amazing, but like it went like this and now it's kind of going more like that.
That's right. So like with transistors, right, there was an inflection point where it was inevitable. Like we figured out that every based on Moore's law, right, every 12 to 16 months, we were literally just double the number of chips, and that would just create an entire, you would capture the value on top of computing power, and that just became a rocket ship. So far, I've not seen the same mechanism unfold in the inference in the intelligence ecosystem. Models are getting smarter. However, the cost is increasing dramatically as well.
This is a good point. Are they even evolving at the same rate as Moore's law? It doesn't seem like it, to be honest.
There is no Moore's law with intelligence.
It's not currently going that fast.
No. Because the entire like premises of Moore's law is you're doubling the density of transistors and also reducing cost at the same time. It's getting cheaper.
Yeah, we don't have that dynamic. I mean, that's a whole nother dimension we haven't talked a lot about. Like, it's not getting cheaper.
It's not getting cheaper, correct. The price is actually going up. And it's like, whether if you blame Jevons paradox, because a lot of people, every single person on the planet wants this or not, that's irrelevant. Because like the whole point of technology is to reduce cost and
it's no one has even mentioned it. It used to get brought up in the beginning, and I haven't even heard anyone talk about it recently. Like, the idea that it should be getting cheaper, but it's not. Like it's a strange paradox.
Well, yeah, the paradox is because the model companies, for incentives for the model companies is completely misaligned, right? The model companies want you to use up as much token capacity as possible so that they can charge you money for it.
Right. Their business model doesn't work in a way that incentivizes them to be efficient.
Correct. Exactly. Exactly. So like their model is their model, the Frontier Labs model, is what like software industry used to be maybe like during the Microsoft days. Like Microsoft as a monopoly had no incentive to sell you better, cheaper software. And
they wanted to sell you like add-ons, different versions, and they forced upgrades.
That's really painful.
Yeah.
They wanted to sell you bulkier, heavier, harder to use software so that you keep buying it and then get locked in. Because once you learn the software, you can't pivot into something else. It really took antitrust to break that apart. And then you spun Google out of this.
Should we move on to the next topic?
Let's do it.
All right. So this was interesting. A company called Physical Intelligence. They are a robotics company. They just became a unicorn, raising $600 million. You know, and we don't talk that much about the hardware defense tech space, but like if you look at where venture capital is going, that's the hottest sector right now. Physical AI, robots. I even saw a chart that showed, dude, I was astounded by this. I wish I had the chart in front of me. Hiring is the strongest at space capsule development. I couldn't believe the categories, like all of these like hardware sectors that at one point were just left for dead. I remember when hardware engineering was just like maybe 10 years ago, electrical engineering, like that was just a really hard place to be. I even had like an offer to go work at some firm that was doing some kind of unique prototyping technology. And my wife was like, look, hardware is just, but now we're seeing this like renaissance in hardware and robots. You've got companies like Tesla and SpaceX, obviously Blue Origin and Jeff Bezos. There's lots of other companies out there that service them and service other aerospace, defense tech too, Anduril, you know, this whole sector. I think it's really exciting. And I think it's, you know, interesting to see companies like this becoming unicorns. What do you think?
Yeah. So, okay. For listeners or viewers, basically this is a robot that makes lattes. It's a latte robot.
You're busting my narrative there. I was like telling everyone how fantastic it is that we're going to go to space and we're going to do all this cool stuff, but we're going to get a robot barista for $1 billion. Yeah, I know.
Okay. I listened to a podcast where Travis Kalanick, Uber, so he pivoted into a robot company, robotics company that Cloud Kitchen, it's called Atoms now, but basically it's like a whole entire physical AI robotics delivery only ghost kitchens, etc. He actually made a really good point. So all of these companies that's making robot in physical form that mimics human makes absolutely no sense. His argument is that like we don't actually currently know what the most optimal robotic form for all of these things are, because all we're doing is trying to build robots that feels, looks like humans, because like subliminally, we're just scared shitless by robots that doesn't resemble humans.
I think it's a good point. Look, I think this is actually very interesting. Do you want to finish?
Well, it basically saying there's a societal force here that all of these generation of robots are doomed to fail. Because we're basically trying to like mimic human likeliness to do like physical things. However, in reality, a lot of things in the physical world are not actually suitable for human type interactions. Like we're terrible at doing a lot of things.
I mean, okay. So I think this is a really great discussion. There's like two philosophies when it comes to robotics. So one is that the world is designed for people. And so a robot that mimics and operates like a person can easily integrate into the existing infrastructure and environment that we've created. Like that would be the overriding philosophical reason that barista bot can, you know, utilize the Italian espresso machine.
Right.
Is a good thing to invest in, right?
Right.
You could sell it to all these different like firms out there and they can just install it with the existing technology. The other perspective would be that no. Creating custom equipment that is specifically designed for a certain type of like scenario or situation will end up being a much more cost efficient and effective way to integrate robots into businesses and our society. Perhaps as we see with like, you know, car manufacturing, right? They're very single purpose, custom built robots that did certain things. They don't really look like people at all.
Yeah, correct.
And I can imagine like certain types of kitchen equipment where you buy the equipment, it's more, it gets more and more automated all of the time.
Yeah.
Like just an evolution of that is ultimately a better way to think about automation and robotics in business.
Correct. So like his argument, it's a really interesting podcast. He's just saying like robotics will get, as robotics gets integrated into our day-to-day lives, more and more things will be built around the robot versus the human. So yeah. Like one example is like our kitchen will have to fundamentally change when it gets more and more automated. The house itself will start to change. Maybe majority of the house will be built for the robot, hidden away behind walls that humans don't interact with and see. And then just robot arms will appear from like, you know, crevices in the walls to complete tasks and then disappear afterwards.
I agree so much with this, actually.
Yeah. So a lot of these present generation of robots who's trying to make lattes with a robot arm just kind of sort of misses the entire point that eventually down the road, maybe in 5 to 10 years, let's say, it's a complete different form.
I think about this all the time with my kitchen. So I remember when like the stove was everything and you wanted like a gas stove.
Right.
And then they invented the microwave and everyone like, it was like, you made like, there was some excitement like, hey, microwave popcorn and reheating stuff is cool. But then there was also this huge backlash. People were like, oh, it's not good for you, which ultimately turned out to not be true.
Correct.
It's just low quality food. Maybe that's true, but it's evolved now. We're like in my kitchen, my new place, like, I have the induction stove, so it's electric, but it like it's lightning fast. It heats up, it's hot. It, like, because electric stoves had a terrible reputation in the past. I have a microwave, which I use for certain things, and it's great. And then I also have like air fryer. Now air fryer is built into everything. Like it's built into toaster, it's built in this. And so that actually is a huge innovation. Like I can heat things up and cook in the air fryer and stuff. And I was thinking the other day how like all this stuff evolved pretty dramatically to where the type of food that I make, it's faster, it's cheaper, it's better, it's tastier. Like, it's not like low quality anymore. Like it used to be that like, oh, you just get cook on the stove, cook in the oven. Like that's the only way to like make anything decent.
Yeah, correct.
And I can see, and I can see this with like the evolution of technology with like robots, like these tools will get better. And like, yeah, your kitchen should be perhaps redesigned in the future with a lot more automation involved. And maybe there's more automation and more robots that are a part of it. Like I could totally see that. I think that makes a ton of sense.
I think he's I know I keep going back to Travis, but I think he's absolutely onto something. Because like, if you think about our lives, the fundamentally probably the one thing that we will actually adopt automation and robotics on is food processing. It's just much safer, cleaner, faster, and better if we can automate processing food. Processing food as in like, you know, going from the entire supply chain all the way to ready-made consumable food.
I understand. It's labor intensive.
It's labor intensive. It takes a long time. The result is not very good if you do it by hand versus do it using a machine to do it.
It's already, and I kept saying that I want a robot to do like laundry and folding and load my dishwasher. They're actually like tasks that take a lot of agility, and I don't know if robots are there yet. But those are the kind of things where I feel like it's a total waste of my time, like making my bed and doing my laundry and folding and all that stuff. Like it takes time. And
that's right.
It's not that's like right. valuable time for me. There's other things I'd rather be doing or I should be doing. And it's funny that we talked about this a long time ago and there was a short I made or that was made of me talking about this. And I got like a bunch of mean comments, which I thought was so interesting that people thought that that was like some type of elitist or... I don't even understand it, to be quite honest. Like, I think it's like really beneficial for everybody. Like if you didn't have to spend as much time doing these mundane household tasks, that frees people up to do all kinds of like more productive things. I know they don't always use it to be more productive, but the opportunity would be there.
Yeah. This is very interesting because it fundamentally is actually a marketing problem, right? Like if you tell people that like, oh, you don't have to cook again, or you don't have to spend your time doing all of these chores, you have to give them a replacement thing. It's like telling me your house don't need a kitchen anymore. That's just getting automated away. So what do I do with the space? Like, what do I put there? Do I put like a, yeah, like another family room? I don't know.
Yeah. You put a TikTok in there, dude. I mean, come on. What else do people want to do with there? You put TikTok everywhere.
Put a gym there.
That's what people want. Put a gym. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's kitchen. What I'd rather be doing. I mean, look, I'd rather be watching the Tour de France than doing my laundry or whatever, right? There's a lot of things I'd like to do. Which that was interesting of all the things we've talked about. Like, that was the one that got a lot of pushback. I don't know. I don't see it all. I still think a robot doing that stuff for me would be great. And I would love to have one. I think that's actually a very difficult task for them to do. Folding. And then you've seen those demos where, like, it has to have the right pressure on the glass. It picks the glass up. It can't, like, break the glass. Like, I don't think it's an easy one to solve for. Where, like, some purpose-built machine that makes lattes, like, they basically already have them. But they could be a lot more automated than they are today. You know,
exactly,
I know, yeah. Like McDonald's and Burger King and fast food, they've long had like a lot of automation in their kitchens. And so I think they'll lead the way on that type of stuff.
Mm.
I think construction is an area where they probably could use a lot more automation and don't. We just, for whatever reason, like haven't done it. But the construction space, I can absolutely see a use case that I think would speed up the production and construction of housing. Like, it could be really beneficial.
Shall we move on?
Yeah. All right, I got this open. Let me see if I can share this. We don't share too many things, but I do think this one is important to show the chart. See if I pull this over. There we go. Now we're talking. So this is fascinating. Tomas Tungsen posted it. And just so everyone's really super clear, like, he's got this Hungarian name that I've actually heard him on podcasts telling everyone that, like, not only are they not pronouncing it correctly, but that basically, if you don't speak Hungarian, you cannot pronounce it correctly. Doesn't exist. That was basically what he said. Not what I said. That's what he said. So he's a legend. He's always got some great content. He posted this chart from The Economist that blew my mind. They took a survey or a questionnaire that's been used to map moral beliefs in a variety of countries since 1981. So 100 countries. So they have data going back to 1981, this survey that you fill out, and it tracks your country, and it helps them, like, take all the responses and create a model of, like, what the values of the people who live in that country are. So, of course, The Economist, redeeming themselves, becoming an excellent publication again, which I'm very excited about, took this questionnaire and gave it to as many AI models as they could, and then plotted it across this chart. And you can see that all the AI models, no matter what they are, no matter who developed them, like if they're Chinese, if they're French, if they're American, they tend to score in the same way and cluster on the same side of the chart, which doesn't match the values of every country. It's a fascinating way to, like, analyze this. So it tends to be more secular. I don't think it's a huge surprise to people, but that's the result. So secular is the top. And then the access across is what they call survival and self-expression. You could perhaps call it conservative and liberal kind of lifestyle worldviews. This is a very difficult thing to talk about because trying to encompass so many different cultures, but I would use some type of, or maybe how you think about yourself. But you can see how it's plotted there. You can see the names of the countries in the region. So, like, African and Islamic countries are in the bottom left. Nigeria is called out. Pakistan's called out. You have Latin America kind of straddles the bottom across self-expression and survival. And then, of course, like, all the English-speaking countries are in the top right quadrant with Britain at the top. So in other English-speaking countries, obviously, like the United States, Canada, Australia, maybe Hong Kong, Singapore be thrown into. Or you can see the U.S. is mapped
right
there. So just, like, fascinating way to analyze this. Yeah. And I think, like, the explanation for it is actually very straightforward. So why would a Chinese model, you know, DeepSeek's on there, Grok is on there, Claude Opus is on there, DeepSeek R1 is way at the top, but DeepSeek V4 Flash is way at the bottom. Like, but why do they all generally score the same way? Do you have a hypothesis before I share it?
Yeah, this is interesting. So I don't think these behaviors are trained into the model themselves. I think they are a post-training adjustment. So with DeepSeek, I'm sure anything that's coming, any models that's coming out of China will have some kind of political sliders or political adjustments to it, right? I think they're applied post-training, and it's a setting that you can move in weeks, not years or month. So it's not, I don't really think it's a risk in terms of for businesses or even individuals.
So interesting. So China is on that graph, and it doesn't map very closely to DeepSeek in terms of values. It's
correct.
On the top
correct.
Left.
Correct.
Right.
So that basically tells me that they're not doing a pre-training filter selection, pre-selection of the data that's going in that fits a certain political secular.
Paul, you would be correct. There's a yeah. reason you're my partner. You're such a brilliant guy. Yes, the theory, we don't know for sure, but the explanation that The Economist gave and most people give for this is that it's all AI, Chinese AI, American AI, is trained primarily on English language information
yeah.
on the internet. And most
basically
of that,
Reddit.
Yeah, and most of that is written by college educated people. And that this
yep.
chart basically maps to what college educated people believe is the simplest explanation for it. Yeah. So it just comes down to like data that you feed it is how it's represented in the AI. But I thought it was fascinating that there's some maybe large differences in some ways, but at a high level, they all ultimately have similar values, which I thought was just fascinating. And it doesn't map at all to like African Islamic values or a country like Nigeria, which is actually an English-speaking country and should be in the English quadrant. I learned that the other day, that the largest English-speaking city in the world is the capital of Nigeria, not London or New York.
That makes sense. Population-wise.
Good, right? good trivia question, right? So I think it calls into question like sovereign AI. That's a real consideration. Like if you look at this chart, you'd be like, this stuff doesn't necessarily reflect my views, our views. Like we're Argentina, we're Saudi Arabia. We are one of these countries that like doesn't necessarily align with how British speaking post-colonial nations in the West do. Right. So I don't know. I just thought it was like really, really, it's like the most quantitative and comprehensive analysis I've seen of AI and its values ever. I love it.
Mm. Yeah, I really enjoyed this. So if we back it up a little bit, basically what you're saying is if the model is trained on data on the internet, predominantly the internet is occupied by like Western English speaking thoughts and
content. I mean, you know, there is a lot of Chinese language content, but like for whatever reason, I don't know why it's not weighted the same way, or it's they're college educated Chinese people. Like I don't know. What do you think?
I think Chinese language itself is much harder to train LLMs on than English language. Like So first of all, like written Chinese versus spoken Chinese is completely different. So that like each individual territory, for example, the way that you write Chinese in Hong Kong is completely different from, let's say, Shanghai or Beijing, even though that you're speaking the same thing. So to kind of like train an LLM for Chinese language, it's much harder, I would say. What I'm actually interested in this is, so like in coding, you're already seeing behaviors, latent behaviors, where you go from, if you're doing complex tasks, you are routed to a model like Opus or Fable. For day-to-day tasks, you will route it to a cheaper model with like Gemini Flash or Sonnet level capability models. I wonder if you would do this with values as well. I don't quite know what the actual applications would be. Maybe like in marketing, will marketers route models by value? Like, does that make sense? Like if you're marketing to a Latin American cohort or demographic, you will route to a specific types of model versus DeepSeek, right? I think what I saw on the chart was that
one version of DeepSeek. Question.
It's on the opposite end of spectrum. Because that would be interesting.
I think there's definitely political ramifications I think the sovereign AI thing is an important question.
Correct. Yeah. So sovereignty AI will, well, yes. So all of the countries, or at least the G7 countries, including China, et cetera, are all discussing sovereign AI. But like the capabilities, there's literally just three or four countries in the world that has capabilities of creating foundational models. Canada, US, China, and like maybe one more. I can't remember.
Does France have, they want one.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. Yeah, literally, it's very few countries in the world has capabilities right now to create AI. So like, it will be interesting, like, for the entirety of Latin America, let's say, and also I'll include Africa in the discussion as well. I there might never be a sovereign AI that targets Latin America,
yeah,
that is native to Latin America, right?
I think that, like, it calls into question the political ramifications of all this stuff. And
correct.
So there is Mistral, there is an LLM from France. But like, yeah, it's an open question. I was gonna say, like, it proves the models have values. I think that was the other thing when I looked at this and I said, fascinating. Like, I think it's proof that there is a value-based system in these models. That I think that the originators right. and creators of it would perhaps deny that. Maybe they wouldn't at this point, but like, they have. I actually asked it to do something the other day, and it told me it wasn't allowed to do that because, like, I asked it to help me persuade people of a certain political group, and it was said, I cannot do that for you. I was
right.
Like, really? Yeah. So there's definitely values there, right?
But the key finding is that that's applied post training, not embedded. It's not an embedding inside of the models themselves. It is
most likely not correct.
So
okay. Good.
Like my final point on that, there is actually a concept of model jailbreaking. Model jailbreaking is basically, for example, you cannot ask Claude to tell you how to make a Molotov cocktail. You cannot tell it how to synthesize meth. But there is a concept of jailbreaking the models so that it will divulge that information. And that is the thing. That is cybersecurity.
All right, let's move on. We got two more things. I think we can just run through these pretty quickly. I thought this was a nice follow-up to all this code transfer about AI. Anthropic says their Q3 2026 profit is over $1 billion. Amazing. I think they've done a great job at executing. Congratulations to Anthropic. Very interested to see if they go public now that they're making an announcement like this. That would be my best guess, is like you make a big profitability announcement like this when you want to go public. And I think if it's true and all this data comes out and they make it, that they're wildly profitable, I think the stock will do quite well in the IPO.
Yeah,
do you want to say on that or yeah?
Okay. So like, I looked at the report. Extremely hand wavy. All of these companies are.
You just think it's some clever accounting.
All of these AI companies, the way that they report revenue and profit is completely, utterly hand wavy. Like, there's a difference between inference profit versus like GAAP gap. Like, basically, if a SaaS company comes out and say, oh yeah, this is profit before cost of like producing the product, you would be like, "That what is this number? Like, what do I do with this number?"
All right. I just say
are using special numbers.
I just say congrats to Anthropic. That's all I want to say on this.
Sure.
Show. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
I understand. Sure. Okay. Yeah, one more. I want to make sure we touch on this. Meta is doing everything it can to make their AI glasses less creepy, but they're just creepy. Like, and this was the thing that I guess I didn't understand, or I didn't think that deeply about it, that the camera built in has like facial recognition. And so it's in this article from TechCrunch. In other words, Meta is confirming that some people who use AI glasses have hidden agendas, namely a desire to record situations or people, often women, without their consent. Like, I think that that is the fundamental problem with like all of these AR, VR glasses is like, let me put it this way. They're created by a bunch of nerdy boys who don't seem to understand that there are all these like issues with like how these things are going to get used.
Yeah.
I like to always jokingly call them like kind of pervert glasses. They're just creepy. And I think it's fascinating actually that these companies are making these things, like it just doesn't seem to really occur to them. And so they're trying to like add in features and functionality to get around, but I'm not sure this will ever be resolved. I think these glasses are just weird pervert glasses. And that's just how the public is going to view them. Do you think I'm wrong?
I agree with you. I can't tell.
You do.
Like, of course. But okay, maybe my counterpoint is this, right? When phone cameras came out, it used to be weird for you to be like taking photos everywhere of like your food on the table at a restaurant, random things in the world. That used to be a weird thing. I very distinctively remember taking photos on your phone was weird, especially at a restaurant. Now everybody does it.
Still lame.
Still lame. But
the last thing I'll
I'm the crazy one who's not taking a photo of the food now.
It's
I'm
still lame to take a photo of
it's
everything
lame,
that
but
you
I'm considered the crazy eat. One.
They eat. Anyway, I'll say this. I'm much more bullish on audio recording AI devices. I think that like the glasses and the like nerd cam and the like pervert and stuff, it's just a bridge too far. But if I just had audio and it recorded everything I did and I could talk to it, it's much less like, it doesn't have the same privacy issues, I think. And like, you could tell people like, hey, I'm recording this, whatever. But I would find that really useful and I would talk to it and it could like remind me and I could like run through an LLM pretty easily. I'm much more excited about that. I think that's a better use for personal AI. I don't think these glasses things are, I think it's why they don't work now. Like, I think the technology is like relatively good. It's almost there. They're not popular at all. Do you know anyone who wears these things around in real life? And
no,
like, we're pretty nerdy. We both wear glasses. Do you even have a pair?
No, I just don't see the practicality. Why would
I don't
I
see
have
it either.
This?
I don't get it at all, right? Like, it's just, but like, I met a guy that had a prototype of like a AI pen that he had made. And I'm like, that's cool. I actually would do that. And then kind of like goes into like a conference call type of system
I
and
just,
it can remember
yeah,
things.
I just
like,
don't
I would
see,
use that.
I just don't see this as a consumer first product in business, maybe like manufacturing. Like, I would love to use this in like my garage or something and it would just tell me how to do things. I think that would be cool. Like a heads up display.
Yeah, right. Okay, so you're correct. Like, there are these niche uses. There's the sports use case. I saw a bicycle helmet now that's got like it all built in. Like, so I can totally see that, but they're really small. They're really niche cases. Like, it's
that's
just
right.
not a big, it's not
yeah,
a big
like a heads up displaying sports or like when you're at home making things with your hands. Yeah, that would be cool. But like as a fashion consumer, I don't know. I don't think so.
All right. Are we done with the show? Anything else want to share, chime in? I got a couple events I'm doing. I'll be at the NASDAQ, what are they calling it? Summit. Actually, I forgot the official name. It's Milestone. They're calling it the Milestone Summit next week in Seattle. I'll do a workshop there.
Very cool.
Yeah, next Thursday.
Cool.
I think it's sold out. You can like try to find tickets. I posted on LinkedIn. It should be fun. Then I'm doing my own Tech Week talk in Seattle for Seattle Tech Week, which very excited about. Almost sold out. And then I have a couple events remainder of the year. So, you know, just go to my website. You can find all that stuff. Probably anything you want to plug.
Currently.
Are you traveling at all? Are you doing any events or anything?
Nope. I'm going to try to stay put.
Just hang out.
Just hanging out in Toronto. Summer is always nice here. So come visit Toronto.
Awesome. All right. I'm good. You done?
Yep. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.